to the App and Appen podcast, a podcast for people working in the real world of IT. If you're a sysappen, work in the help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, a computer techie, want to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Jerry. And at the moment, there's no Andy tonight, so we're just winging it, really. I'll fill in the Andy bit this week. I'm the guest Andy this week. We've had John the Nice Guy and so on before, but it's episode 59. Welcome to episode 59. The number 59, there's a few facts associated with that. 59 is the 17th prime number, and it's approximately the number of days in two lunar months. And it's also the bingo nickname for 59 is the Brighton line. So it's 59, the Brighton line, right? You might have two fat ladies next, or legs at 11, or whatever. Also, the A59 runs from Wallasey to York, so across a big part of the north of England. And there's also the Type 59 tank, which is a Chinese-produced version of the Soviet T-54 tank. Probably used quite extensively in the Cold War, I would have thought. I'm no expert, but I just had a quick look at the Wikipedia page. So how is everyone?
Yeah, I'm good. How about you? You're back, so that's good.
I'm back, yeah, after quite an absence. I'm back and raring to go.
Cool. First things we'd like to just mention today, I forgot to mention last week, and after hearing what the Joe message he said about us really appreciated him actually doing that and carrying his kit around, because he had to bring his mixer back on the Sunday, so I really appreciate that, so thank you, Joe.
So he produced the Oddcam live show, right?
Yes, so he recorded it with his gear, and then he just edited it for us as well, so thank you very much.
He said on Late Night Linux that it's one of the best audio quality of any of our episodes.
Yeah, so that's number one at the top. Actually, I think that might be one of our most ever downloaded episodes, actually, I think.
Wow.
So,
well, hello to any new listeners. Sorry that I couldn't be part of that, but I had other things to deal with the Odd Camp weekend, so here I am now. Anyway, I've actually been listening to all those podcasts, like all the live podcasts that were recorded at Odd Camp, people talking about Odd Camp. They've obviously heard it through friends of friends and so on. I heard it on the, I think it was the Iron Sysadmin podcast. They even mentioned it. So
what they mentioned? They mentioned it. So that's good. So what have I been up to? Obviously, being on Odd Camp, you always get back and you want to learn more stuff. So, like, I've been really covering the open source a couple of weeks. I've been written some Python scripts. John Nice Guy was saying about Home Assistant, which is like an open source Home Assistant application, which has got loads of plugins and stuff. So, it's really nice if you've got like an Echo or you've got like lights you can turn on remotely, like those Philips Hue lights. But I had what I wanted it for is that I wanted to know when people were at home or away, so that I could like tell sometimes if I can't get contact my wife or whatever or something like that, or without messenger, I want to just check on the website that you can. It's basically quite good. So it's basically it does presence, so it like tell you, so it just pings your mobile phone. So if it knows it's at home. I basically gave all our devices at home not static IP address, but a DHCP reservation, and it basically, if it can ping it will basically show it's online, if it's away, and also wants to know when the kids were using the media PC in the morning if they get up too early or whatever on the Saturday, so you can see when the TV's been on, kind of thing. So from like one control panel.
So is that a piece of software that runs on Linux?
Yes, I think it can run on Windows as well. It's written in Python 3. I'll put a link in the show notes.
Right,
and it's really good. It's kind of, there's loads of stuff, and it's very customizable. You can do anything with it. So what I've also done is that, have you heard of talking before about MicroTix, There's an interface on there where you, it's basically you can, there's like a win box you can go to, or a, which is a Winners application, or you can go by the web to configure it, or you can go by Telnet, or sorry, Putty, or SSH, sorry. And I wanted to basically stop the kids, they're only like six or whatever, so but I wanted to like basically just stop internet access to like the TV or the iPad. So I've enabled some rules on my on the MikroTik, so that if you go to, so like if that IP address, if one's to block the internet for that, I basically just block the IP address going out to the web. So I put deny rule on that IP address, and they're basically just rules which are all, I'm only disabled, but I wanted to enable them. Like if the kids want to go at the table or whatever, or it's time for bed, I can just go to my phone, go to this Home Assistant webpage, and you can do like toggle switches, and that toggle switch can basically run a Python script. So the Python script basically SSHs onto my MikroTik and enables the rule, which basically then stops that device from having internet access. So nice. And then you could basically click it again and it will basically disable it. So you could probably do it even like on time-based thing by the this Home Assist. So two things I wanted to tell you is, I wanted, because I know that John the Nice Guy uses Git and stuff, and he's obviously put his code up on there. I wanted to do the same with like all my scripts. So maybe at some point I wanted to, if you could get, cause I'm guessing if you've used Git in the past, haven't you, to do some of your code and
stuff? Yeah, I mean, I use it, you know, I sort of put it on my CV that I know how to use Git and so on. So, I think I'm fairly proficient. Rebasing still scares me, but because you can delete history, apparently. But,
okay.
But yeah, I'd say I'm intermediate.
Okay.
I'm not going to say I'm an expert.
No, but what are the basics? Like, I guess you got to have SSH keys or SSH keys. But you got to have like your keys or whatever to upload and stuff. And then And also about security, you could, you got to remember take your passwords out of it, I'm guessing as well.
I've found the best strategy there is to put all your secrets in one place, in a you know, one directory or something.
Okay.
And then find some way of encrypting it. Yeah. So either make the code generic so that your secrets are variables and you can put them in from somewhere else, and so you can upload everything, all your code apart from the secrets, kind of thing. And then if you do want to put it on, say, GitHub or Bitbucket or one of those services, I would suggest using Gitcrypt. I was actually going to talk about this a bit later, but that will basically upload an encrypted blob onto these services, and then you have the keys on your system. It uses GPG to encrypt and decrypt. So it's transparent. So very basic outline of how Git works is you download the whole repository to your local PC, and what Gitcrypt does is it decrypts it as you download it, and then encrypts it as you upload it. So if you look at the code on your computer, it's decrypted. If you look at it online, it's encrypted. So that's the basic what I'd do for that. If you want to use a service like that, this is an exercise that I'm going to be going through with all my code, my freelance stuff. I'm going to be using Bitbucket to back up all my Git stuff, but I'm going to go through and make sure the secrets are taken out or put somewhere safe or where I know where they are, and then encrypt those and then upload them. The thing with Bitbucket is you can have private repositories for free that no one else can see. With GitHub, you have to pay for the private repositories. It's not much, but you still have to pay for it.
Oh.
So try and do it the free way first, and then.
Because I just want to put anyone wants to see my code for like my Home Assistant and then my Python script as well. Also, somewhere to like back it up. So yeah. We can go into major details about that later. Yeah. All about branch.
I mean, it is a big problem with GitHub. You can do a search for like MySQL password, and you get hundreds of thousands of results where people have just uploaded the code without thinking about the fact that there might be secrets in there. So
I've got my Python scripts, but I've also quite good. So as a female camp, I was like talking about the last episode about Ruby, and then I've gone and basically got on to programming in Python and using the actual Atom as a web, as a, like the editor, kind of thing, which is quite cool.
Oh, yeah.
And
I've used Atom, yeah.
The other thing as well is a book called The Code Manual for the Owner's Handbook, which is a Haynes one, which actually is written by the Mike Saunders of the...
Oh, yeah.
And it's,
I remember them talking about
it. It's really good. This is the kind of book I wanted to... It's not... It's really good because some of the books I read is like, it's like for right novices. And this one's kind of got like, this is what I was speaking to John about, is that I wanted something which will basically just tell you what all the things are, like what strings, variables are, and things like that. Because they kind of gloss over them, say, oh, you have a string, is it, or what a function is. I want to know what all those things are so I can basically... kind of make my code more efficient, kind of thing. And when I read other people's codes, so I kind of understand it, kind of thing.
I'm just kind of learning this sort of stuff now, with mainly because of Ansible, because I did a load of stuff and kind of did it the long way. I mean, you're talking about that Tom Scott video where he shows you kind of how to program and how you go through refactoring it and so on to make it more efficient. And as I was doing stuff in Ansible, I thought, oh, there must be an easier way of learning to write it all out, you know, multiple times. And that's where you start to learn about these things. And yeah, I'm using, I've used Bash as well, and you have an idea of functions in there. But it's really, I think for me, it's time to get onto these sort of more complex, I suppose, programming languages like Python, Ruby. And really sort of start doing stuff properly.
But definitely check out that book. I'll put a link. I got it from the library, so to like check it out first before I bought it. I mean, I've got a Python book I bought at Christmas time, but that's just got loads of things. But this is kind of good because it's kind of like set out in different sections. So yeah, have a look at that.
Is it a particular language, or is it
Python?
Python. Oh, it's in Python, right? Yeah, okay. I think it's been mentioned before. This book is like an online book, Automate the Boring Stuff with Python, and I got kind of quite a long way through that, but then I got stuck on one of the exercises and kind of never went back to it. And all the free time that I had to do it was taken up with freelance work again, so I never went back to it. There's some stuff that I've been using at work that is Python based, and it's interesting. As soon as I got faced with a bit of Python to kind of writing in Python or debugging or whatever, it was all a bit, I found it quite hard to get my head around. Whereas I think you were saying a couple of episodes ago or last episode, Ruby is a lot easier to read. It looks like it might be easier to learn Ruby now, so I might go that
well
way.
I started to learn Ruby and then I got onto Python because I wanted to Python is what I needed to what I wanted to do. So but that's kind of that's my home assistant thing that I'm quite happy about. I think you've got quite a bit to talk about, so I'll let you go on about
I mean, where do I start, really? So day job. I've been doing a bit with. I haven't written it in the notes here, but I've been given the task of helping with the automation. There's an automation effort going on there. Basically, they've got a good product, but the infrastructure behind it is basically crumbling. So there's a guy, my boss has been there for 6 months, and he's just sort of tearing his hair out, wondering. He's kind of at this stage where he's too scared to touch anything in case it breaks. So it's a case of doing this automation stuff really carefully, automating what they've got, first of all. And they decided on Ansible for that, which is why they brought me in. And the thing is that this guy wants testing, actual automated testing, for any of the so-called Ansible roles. these are the little modular bits of code that can get reused in Ansible. They're called roles. He wants each role to be tested or to have tests applied to it which pass. So if someone takes the code and changes it, then that code gets tested automatically, and before it gets kind of in somewhere where it can be used for running on machines that might be in production or whatever. So I've been looking at these test frameworks. The first one I looked at was called Molecule. Now this is a Python thing. It's basically a thing which will bring up a Docker container by default, and then it runs a playbook, an Ansible playbook that you give it, which will set up this Docker container in such a way, and then it will run tests on it. And then there's a sort of testing language called Test Infra, where you write this Python code, which says things like, this file should exist here, it should have these permissions, or this port should be open, this service should be running, and you write it all in Python, and you know, you can do loops and things like that and so on. It's like a language, you know, it's like a programming language for testing, and that's called Test Infra. So I was looking at that all seems pretty good, but the only issue there was it only really runs on Linux at this point. So all of this stuff is quite it's kind of my boss described it as a Wild West. it seems to be people just going out there and doing whatever works, and all of these tools are quite basic and it's almost untested themselves.
So can I ask then? So the testing of it. So if someone changes some Ansible code, they want to make sure it doesn't break your production. Then how does the testing know if it breaks it or not?
There's two aspects to this. There's unit tests. So the unit tests will be on the roles themselves. So there you set up you do a very simple Ansible role where it says, is this installed? The role is supposed to install it, so is it installed? So is the binary there? Is the service running? If it's a service, is the port open? Is this file in this particular part of the file system?
Ansible do that though when you check it?
It does do it, but you might have typo. It's part of this sort of workflow called test-driven development, which is being used pretty much everywhere in kind of web programming these days. So you write a load of tests before you even write the code in a lot of cases, and then you write the code, and if you need to rewrite the code, you run it through these tests again just to make sure that the tests pass. If they don't pass, you go and rewrite it until they do.
Cool.
And then you can add, you can obviously add new tests as and when. I think with infrastructure, it's a lot. The tests are quite probably simpler than in an actual, an application that you might be running.
So what about Kubernetes or whatever it's called? Is that the test platform or?
No. Well, Kubernetes, where I'm working, is kind of in the pipeline. They've actually, this other company's gone away and written this massive big kind of framework for them, and they're not really in a position to use it yet, which is a shame. So that sort of transition is going to be quite interesting, because it's going to mean putting all this stuff that they've got very much on bare metal in some cases into Docker containers, which is, it's going to be interesting. But I think this test driven infrastructure stuff will help with that eventually. Anyway, so this whole testing thing Molecule would be fine if we just had Linux boxes, but at work we've got Windows boxes as well. So I've been looking at ways of testing Windows infrastructure as well. Now the thing that's been used for the longest in this space is Test Kitchen, which is a Chef thing. Chef, the configuration management software, and that the language that's used with that, you can use different languages, but the one that it kind of comes with is called Server Spec, and that's a very simple looking language that does kind of what I described the testing for it does, but it looks a lot cleaner than the Python code. And apparently it's possible to use this on Windows as well, but I'm just puzzling out how to do that at the moment. I mean, if any listeners have any pointers, do let me know. But yeah, Server Spec on Windows doesn't seem to be playing particularly at the moment.
What level? What version of OS is this?
On Windows, yeah. I think they've got 2008 and 2012.
Okay. With the 2012 boxes, you can use DSC, which is desired state configuration, which you can use, which is PowerShell basically, and you can do the same thing where you can say, right, is this server installed? Is this service installed? Yes. Is this file here? Yes, kind of thing.
Because it's using, because they're planning on using Ansible for the Windows stuff as well, and they're going to be using WinRM for that.
Yeah.
So I don't know how that works through that, but that's what I've got to figure out. Anyway, and no, I'm not quite there yet, and I've been on it for a couple of weeks as well, which is.
So what about this Ansible Tower thing? What's all that about? I saw.
Do you know? I only saw that in the chat room today. I haven't had a chance to look at it. Ansible Tower is basically a GUI for Ansible, though. I know that much, but it was kind of always their paid offering. So before they got bought by Red Hat, it was the kind of the thing that they would sell to make money, would sell to big companies and stuff. And I was actually at the Ansible Fest 2 years ago, I think, and they were saying about open sourcing it then. But yeah, I only had a quick look at the GitHub page today when I saw that on the Telegram group, which is obviously at admin.podcast.co.uk/Telegram.
That's cool. What else have you got to say?
What else? If you said this, it's in the notes, but I know. We're going to backups later, shall we? So we'll talk about that later. I've used my first DigitalOcean droplet for actual real world use. In this case, just a simple LAMP server. I've got this job to, funnily enough, it's the back end of this website uses bash scripting for everything, so for updating database and that kind of thing. It's got a massive directory of bash scripts which does all this downloading data and sticking it in the database and that sort of thing. And rather than muck around on the actual production server, I've fired up a DigitalOcean droplet to muck around with. So if the worst happens, I can always nuke it and start again, you know, take a snapshot before I do anything. And that sort of thing. I could have done that on Vagrant, kind of, on my local machine, but I wanted it available, you know, so other people could log into it and so on. So that's that. I'm just kind of in the middle of that now, so I'm going to have to report back on that.
Did you use Ansible scripts to set that up or not?
I used it to set up Apache because I've got a role that does that already. The other stuff, not so much. It's just installing a few packages, really. I don't know how much to go into this. I've started using a project layout for Ansible. So at the moment, I've got all my Ansible code in a big, massive directory. All the roles are in there. All the playbooks which use the roles for different people's servers are in there. But this time I've got a project for this project. and I've got a subdirectory which is called Ansible, and the roles directory is still outside that project, and I've got like a little area for notes and that kind of thing. And if there's any other stuff, like if I had to use Terraform, I'd put the Terraform stuff in the subdirectory of that. So it's just a different way of laying out your code to on a project basis, rather than just having it all smushed together in one big directory. So that's, yeah, interesting enough the way I'm doing things. What else we got? Oh yeah, I was inspired by John Spriggs. I think it was the last episode he mentioned about Kanban.
Yes.
And there's this service called Trello, and I've started using it for everything. So the idea, I guess, is you have to do or backlog, in progress or doing, and then done, and you've got these cards that you move between these three columns, hopefully in always going to the right so that they're done. And I've got several different boards now. Let me just bring them up. I've got one for I've got one for the podcast.
Hey.
It's only got a couple of cards on there. And what else have I got? I've got for my freelance stuff, because I was forever getting in a muddle about who needed what and what time they needed it by and so on. I used to just use email for that, but it wasn't really working. So all that stuff's on the Kanban board now. I've got one for work, so just things that are outside the sort of Jira ticketing system. If someone just asks me to do something, I'll put it on this board. And the other kind of big one is I called Life Admin. So it's just everything that I need to do around the house, or bills that need paying, or people I need to get in touch with, or things that I need to do, goes onto my Trello board. And the to-do column is massive at the moment, and the other columns are quite small, but hopefully that I can change that in time and get things done and not forget to do things. So thanks to John for that. Trello's also got a mobile app as well, which is really quite usable.
I tried to use that and I got into it, but I still like my workflowy best is when I use with the where you can kind of up and down things. It's quite good. So I guess it's one-to-one, own to your own, really, isn't it? That kind of thing. I tried a number of things before I got to the one I like, kind of thing. So,
yeah, well, I've never tried this before, but it's handy to just, you know, you can write things on your phone.
Yeah.
You can have cards, you can have checklists on.
You have lists, like you have lists, like, as well, can't you? So.
Yeah. I mean, I've done a card that's just a shopping list.
Yeah.
You know. So you go shopping and you can tick everything off when you got it, and it works really well. I was trying to use Evernote for that kind of thing before, but that didn't really work that well. It's a bit slow and I didn't like the website. And So thanks to Joel for that. Inspired me with that. I think I signed up to Trello after that podcast, immediately afterwards. So I need to sort something out. enough chatting from me for a minute. Do you want to say a bit more about what you've been doing?
A couple of things. Yes, we've done about the programming book, how to use Git. Replacement for Crash Plan, I'm guessing, is quite a hot topic at the moment. So I was using Crash.
Yeah, apparently. So they're closing down their personal one, is that right?
Yeah, so I had an email about a week ago or 2 weeks ago about it. So I basically just use Crash Plan. The only reason I use it is for one of my Macs, or my wife's Mac, which basically backs up their photos to cloud. And it works. It just sits there and works. $5 a month works really well. So
there's
they're basically only going to go to they're going to go to business only, which is a bit annoying because we've obviously paid for them a bit. And so their options, like I said, they basically, you can either go to their pay plan or their business plan, which I think they give you 70% off for the first year. I think it works about $30 a year for the first year, but obviously, I'm guessing what they do, if you forget, then you go to get charged more. But obviously, I've got like 400 gigs worth of photos with them. If I go somewhere else, I'm going to have to upload all those photos again. But I think if you go for their reading online, if you go for their business plan or whatever, the next one up, you can. I think it just uses it just somehow. You don't have to upload all your document or all your photos again. So, but you were saying looking at Backblaze.
Yes. Yeah. I've been thinking about it for a while because they've got a command line client. And an API and so on that you can talk to. So I was thinking of using that, not only for me, but for my freelance clients, because in some cases I'm backing up their data and I've got this dedicated server that I'm backing up to. Yeah. But I really want to kind of take that to pieces a bit. And I use it to experiment with Kubernetes. I was thinking of doing a Kubernetes on a single server kind of thing. On a single bit of hardware. Backblaze seemed like the obvious choice. And apparently one way of doing this would be to Amazon S3, but Backblaze apparently cheaper, which is well done to them for undercutting Amazon on that one. I don't know if you've heard Steve Gibson talking about this. So he's got it set up for his office secretary's PC or something. And he pays $2 a month for his backups.
Yeah, using
even though he's got all the gigabytes sitting there, that you don't get charged for that apparently, or you get charged a fraction of a penny for it. And it's a similar model with CrashPlan, I think.
Using S3, isn't it? Kind of thing.
I don't know if he is using S3 because you often hear that they publish reports about hard drives and hard drive failure rates and things like that.
That's what Blackbase, isn't it? But I was about Ski Gibbons said he was just using his backup to S3, isn't he? That's what he is.
That's right, yeah. No, I thought you might be saying that Backblaze is backed by S3.
No.
As in they're using S3. But no, yeah, they seem to be using their own hardware, their own hard drives and so on. They obviously they take this kind of thing seriously. that's my plan is to transition these clients over to Backblaze. Just install this binary, which is actually another Python thing. It's installed using pip. I've got my account set up. I've got the so-called buckets, which is basically directories that you store the data in. Or sort of top level directories anyway. And then what I'm going to do is try duplicity on the actual servers, which will apparently just give you I think that's Python, so Python's everywhere. But what duplicity offers is that you can encrypt the backups using GPG as you do them. So you're storing the data on somebody else's infrastructure, so you want to make sure that it's encrypted in case someone gets in there and tries to siphon off your said data, I think that's a sensible thing to do. But you can use GPG as you back up with Backblaze, and you do incremental backups and all this kind of stuff. But obviously the real test with any backup is being able to restore it. I have to do some testing there. That's my take on backups, really.
Cool. Okay, well, I might have a look at Backblaze. I think it's the same price as what CrashPlan was, and they always say they publish their results, don't they, kind of thing.
I should say I was using Backblaze myself. CrashPlan myself, and because it was the only one of these services that you could run on Linux. It's got a Java client, I think. So I was running that. The thing is, my NAS has been turned off for a long time now, so I don't really the data that I've got. I think apart from scarily my freelance stuff. Because it's got loads of secrets in it, so I don't want to just back it out willy nilly. Until this Backblaze sort of thing came along, I haven't really got a great backup strategy for the freelance stuff. So really that's the kind of stuff that needs to be backed up. I think otherwise pretty much all our data is somewhere else or online, or you know, pretty safe, I'd say. The main thing is obviously the photos, which we use Google Photos, and a long time ago I uploaded all our photos to Picasa, mm-hmm. the Google, which was an old Google service, and they all got imported into Google Photos. So
that's cool.
That's the only data that I really, really care about, that we can't, you know, you could never get back if it was lost, and it's with Google, so it's kind of, you know, it's safe enough, I think. You know, even though they've got it, I'd rather that they had it and it was safe than, you know, the hard drive died tomorrow and all your data's gone, all your photos gone. So.
Cool. Did you have, what are you going to talk about? Have you got any response to what we, about the last episode you've not been on then? So you've got one when we were on Odd Camp, where we had the, with John and Martin, about the whole, I was asking about how, about how to get Linux support, from the question from my boss kind of thing. So,
I mean, I was just going to say, obviously, that's why Canonical exists, isn't it? I mean, they provide support packages for Ubuntu, right? I mean, they also work on Ubuntu, obviously, but they are primarily a company which provides support for Ubuntu if you pay for it. And that seems to be the sort of overriding open source model, is that you give away the software for free and then you charge money to support it. And supporting it can mean even rewriting the software that you've distributed to make it work for someone. But the beauty of it being open source is once you make those changes, then you have to publish them. You have to make the changes public, and everyone benefits.
I mean, so I haven't actually seen anyone actually buy support from anyone, that's all. So I didn't know what the kind of what the service was or whatever. And then same as what you were having, is that it's obviously the Wild Wild West is kind of getting that support. So
it depends what you have to think about what you're going to use in that case. I mean, this Molecule, I found the developer was very responsive. In fact, he asked me if something was fixed, and I haven't yet replied to him, which is bad. But you know, you can just ask a question on GitHub, do a GitHub issue, and get a reply. And if that happens, then you know things are pretty good in that case. And especially if they're nice about it, because I've talked to developers on GitHub before that are just not very nice. So it's kind of, I mean, as a contractor consultant type, you have to be aware of that kind of thing, don't you?
Yeah, I think it's asking me more about is that, like, if something goes wrong in the middle of the night or something breaks and then you have to fix it, it's just trying to work out how you fix it kind of thing. But I'm guessing if you're, like Martin was saying, if you're using the system day in, day out, most things that... you were kind of using will know what the issue was kind of thing. So
I mean, yeah, it's just making sure your monitoring's up to spec and it's monitoring what it needs to monitor. I mean, the teams that I've worked in, you have quite a small ops team or sysadmin team, and then once you've started there and you're up to speed with everything, you know, you just someone is on call, and then if that person needs to call someone else, then they will, and everyone just get together and try and fix it. And the beauty of having everything in code is that if someone like a developer's made a commit that's gone in, and then something's broken, then you can just say, oh, it happened around this time when this commit was, this Git commit, you know,
yeah,
this code commit. And the same with if sysadmin has done that, that's why, you know, it's good to have everything in code, infrastructure as code, or code as infrastructure.
Yeah, I mean, that's what, yeah. And as you say, if you've got infrastructure as code, you can then just publish it, push it out again. So if you have a web server die or whatever, you can just push it out again, can't you?
Yeah. But I mean, with these sort of complex systems you have, it could, you could make a change that you don't realise it has an effect somewhere down the line.
Yeah.
But it's, if you made it, if you say, oh, this happened at, you know, 10 to 6 on Friday, then, you know, just after everyone's gone to the pub, then you can look in the Git commit log that that happened at that exact time, and you, at least you can, you've got somewhere to start, you know. It's just the complexity of systems these days, yeah, that make it almost essential to kind of work in that way. Yeah.
So that was episode, Yog Camp episode. Anything about the other podcast?
It's been a couple of weeks since I listened to
that was one about where we were just talking about, because you did the other thing to talk about, that was all, when you said about it.
Yeah, well, it was the Trello thing was the thing that stuck out, okay, for me, and because I've been using it so much since, I just almost don't know what I did without, yeah, it. So this time when my wife asks me to do something, it gets added to the list and it actually gets done instead of me forgetting, yeah, about it. So yeah, it's good.
Yeah, that's cool.
There was a couple of other things actually. You were saying about MikroTik router.
Yeah.
I've heard about this router firmware thing called LEDE, which seems to be like a, I don't know if you've heard of OpenWRT.
Yes.
So I think the thing that interested me about it was I thought it would run on the router that I've got, a TP-Link router. But apparently it doesn't, but I need to get a slightly different version, and then I can run this alternative firmware, which looks pretty interesting, just to be able to do more stuff with my router and a bit of hacking, hopefully not cut the whole house off and cut off everyone's TV. But yeah, so I might be a little project to do.
So you haven't gone off, brought one of those GPD pockets, have you? Have you ordered one?
No, I'm tempted to though, because they're not that expensive and they look quite nice. And I spoke to someone that's got one and he says they're pretty good.
Yeah, there's a couple at Odd Camp which people had. I like the idea of them, but they do seem quite, the keyboard does look quite small though, doesn't it? So
it does, yeah, and it's got the little nipple for moving the mouse around, which I've never really got on with, but apparently it's perfectly usable, nice high res screen, and you plug it into a big monitor and it works fine apparently. So it's good to carry around and use if you need to, and then if you can have a plug it into, you know, sit down at a desk and plug it in,
yeah,
it works really well apparently. Works well with Ubuntu. Apparently the touchscreen doesn't work properly in Ubuntu.
Okay. That's not too bad, about £400 for it, is it, for it? Or
yeah, so I was thinking of cutting into the company funds to try one out. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, definitely.
So they've got 8 gig of RAM then, and then yes, but if people don't know, it's like a little 7-inch tablet with a keyboard, isn't it? With like a full size.
Yeah. And it's kind of it looks like a MacBook Pro a bit with the it's kind of made out of aluminium and so on. So it's like a half a MacBook Pro basically.
Cool.
And, yeah, stick it in your pocket and.
Yeah, we'll put a link in the show notes to it, kind of thing, to have a look at it.
Yeah. I thought, I mean, if it was any more expensive, I'd be thinking, oh no, it's too expensive. But for what it is, it seems really good.
Cool.
You never know. I might be doing the next podcast from it.
So, what have I been doing? Not a lot, really. I've been quite a lot involved with another project, the same project I was doing at the start of the year, is they've got another one to do, so can't really talk about much about that, but I'm going to be spending most of my time in Southampton for the next couple of weeks, and then a trip to Germany, looks like it, so that's all interesting.
Okay.
I have been doing Azure Stack quite a lot. So it's actually, I didn't really think about it until John was mentioning OpenStack the other day. I was like, hang on, it's quite... So Azure Stack is basically Azure in your own data center. So it's the same code and the same interface to control it. So it's got the same got the same web and same API as the what you get in the web. So whatever you run your code to do in on Azure, you can put it to your internal boxes, and it will do the same thing. Not all the features are there yet. What you can get in Azure Stack, but it's for people like who need to have the data in certain places and they're not allowed to have it elsewhere, kind of thing. So one of our customers has to have control of their data. It can't go into public cloud, but they want to have the flexibility of Azure. So because they're Windows developers, so you can only.
So is it kind of blessed by Microsoft then?
Yes.
So basically, by Microsoft. Oh, okay.
So Microsoft basically produce it, and what it is that you can only buy it on certain hardware. So there's only three people at the moment which hardware you can buy it on. So you can either buy it on HPE, Dell, or Lenovo, and I think that Cisco is coming at the end of the year, but it can only go on certain hardware. They only certify to certain hardware for certain firmware on it. So it's all on DL380s, which that's a 2U rack, 2U server, with it's basically using storage spaces. So there's no SAN in it or anything. So it's basically just got disks in the front of it.
Yeah,
and
I think I've worked with those before. Those HP ProLiant things.
Yeah, so DL380s, they're 2U. 360s, they're 1U. So you get two processors in it, and you basically at release you can only buy. You have to basically, you can't add extra ones after you brought it because the code isn't there to do that. But apparently by Christmas as well, it should be able to add it. So they reckon for the first 3 months, you should buy enough to with your to do your for your workload. And so basically, there's basically Hyper-V hosts running Windows 2016 and a load of VMs on it, which will basically mimics Azure, and you can basically log on to this Azure Stack, and then Microsoft's, they're not responsible for the underlying technology for looking after it. They basically provide all the VMs what need to run it, but it's all closed. You can't get to it, so you have a thing called Azure Operator, which is like someone like me or would look after it. And if there's any error message or anything, you can obviously try and fix it yourself, but if not, you basically back it off to Microsoft or your hardware provider, in our case HPE. It uses a thing called storage spaces, which is a bit like ZFS but over the network. It's a kind of thing called three-way mirror, so that your data will be in three places at once. So but it's over three servers, so that if you use a server, your data will guarantee to be on two other servers. And it uses a technology called network cards, called RDMA, which is Remote Direct Memory Access, which is basically 10 gig networking. But when it writes data to another server, so if your VM's on one server and it writes a write to your local hard drive, it obviously also got to write it to two other servers. And using this RDMA card will not use any processing power. It's all done through the networking stack. Over the 10 gig network, it will write it to a remote memory in another server so that it can write it to its hard drive really quickly, if that makes sense. What happens is the data would go into the CPU, go to the network, and then back across the LAN, up through the network stack, through the CPU, and then back on the disk. But that cuts it out. So, but these cards are quite expensive. But with Azure Stack, you have to all the computers have to be they're only certified one DL380. Because what happens is that when Microsoft release an update, all they do is they literally just blank the hard drives. Well, that's actually VHD. So, like, you know, if you get a VHD for a virtual machine.
Yeah.
And how you can move that around machines. What you do is you just boot your physical server off a VHD. So they basically just don't even bother up with patching the server. They just basically just download the new VHD to the server and say, boot up this VHD to this one. So it's quite interesting.
It sounds like a weird hybrid between VMware and an actual cloud thing, doesn't
yes.
it? It's interesting.
Yeah.
No one else is doing it, are they? I mean VMware have got the kind of what Microsoft are offering with this thing almost, but obviously you can go in there and change things and stuff with VMware. And I'm guessing that the API is, well, from what I can see with Terraform anyway, Terraform talks to the APIs for these different things. And you can't really do a lot with Terraform or VMware. You can do much more with Azure. So I guess you get the Azure API in a box, as it were. Yeah.
Which is quite good, because also there's no cost, there's no Azure costs. You just basically buy the hardware from your supplier, but they charge you per your VM. So you don't buy any software from Microsoft. They just charge you what they use. So by storage and by CPU usage. So how many CPUs you need a month, but also means you get to run the latest OS as well in your. Obviously, it's a lot cheaper because obviously, you have to buy the hardware and you're paying the power and the networking in the data center. So I haven't got the prices, but I'll put a link in the show notes to a link to what shows you what the cost is. So that's quite interesting.
They do sometimes do interesting things, Microsoft. Like I always thought the Windows Home Server was quite interesting. This must have been getting on for 10 years ago now. But it was just this thing where... It was basically file storage, but I think you had this plugin model where you could write different, developers could write things which plugged into it to, I don't know, you could, like maybe have an MP3 server or something to talk to iTunes or something like that. And it had this way of replicating data across different hard drives. This is what reminded me of what you were saying just now. It wasn't RAID, it was something that guaranteed that data would be on as many hard drives as you put in the case, which I think it's just like a normal PC case, and you could guarantee that the data would be on a number of different hard drives, but it wasn't RAID, because RAID's a bit kind of, it's all kind of all or nothing and lower level, whereas this was OS level kind of thing.
Yeah. It's quite good. It's basically, these servers have there's no RAID card. They're just like a pass-through mode. So it's like ZFS where it uses a SATA controller and then goes to SATA. Okay. That's my list. A couple of things. With the Answers Admin podcast, they were talking about Hack My Derby, which sounds quite interesting.
Oh, yeah.
I think I got my head around it, what they're trying to do with this DerbyCon thing with the hats and with the data center in the hats, and they've got he's got like a little challenge to hack his Derby, which is quite interesting.
When didn't he say they were walking around with these hats with the Raspberry Pis in?
Yeah, this is it, this, with the Raspberry Pi.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
I was wondering if we should do something maybe at Odd Camp next year with the same kind of thing. So, so basically, they've got a Raspberry Pi. Is it a W? Which is the zero W?
Yeah,
a zero. And
it's the one with the Wi-Fi.
Yeah,
basically
the zero. And they've got like a USB charger in it to charge it, to power it, kind of thing. And that connects to the web. And he's basically got Docker running it on the side of it, and then he's got a number of things so people can try and hack it, and then if they get a code, they can go to like a scoreboard and then put it in, kind of thing. So I was kind of wondering if we should maybe do the same sort of thing, maybe have a speak to them, see if we can get the code, and then have a go at Odd Camp with it next time, maybe.
Sounds good.
Maybe not have a Derby, because I didn't realise Derby was a hat. I never really,
top hat,
yeah, maybe it's top hat for people in the UK, kind of thing. And they've got like a little LCD thing as well. So if you hack it, you can kind of put text on the screen kind of thing. So I feel it'd be quite good if people tried hacking it at Ogcamp or something. If someone made something different kind of thing. And maybe have maybe for a good talk as well at Ogcamp. So
yeah. And there's talk of another Ogcamp. I thought I heard a talk of another Ogcamp.
Yeah, John did.
Who knows?
John did say that.
That was on the Ubuntu podcast,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. So we've just got to keep pestering him until one magically appears next year. Because I'm a bit gutted that I missed this year. So I had to go. I was there on the Saturday morning. I saw a couple of talks, but I had to leave about lunchtime. So. I'm really gutted, but I'm definitely going to be at the next one, and I'm going to be doing the crew as well, because I did half a day this time, and I want to do what I say I'm going to do next time. So I hereby volunteer for the crew, John. just let me know.
One last thing before only thing I've got is that's another recommendation from the Iron Sys Admin podcast, was this new part I heard called Record Reply All.
I'm already listening to that one. Yeah.
All right. How long have you been listening for it? For quite a long time.
A couple of months, probably.
All right. I really enjoy it. I mean,
for
the last couple have been quite good, where they've had the bit where they're basically tracked down some people who were doing the phone telephone scam.
That's really good, wasn't it? Basically, you get a thing comes up on a web page and it says your PC is infected and says call this number. The host of this show called the number and started speaking to the guys in the end and actually, you know, building up a relationship and stuff. And they end up going to India, don't they?
Yeah.
And,
right.
Yeah, it's a really interesting story.
It's really well produced and... I've listened to the latest one's about the toll free numbers, and this woman's getting spooked calls on it, like voicemails with like random people calling her. And some of the back episodes are a bit weird. I'm just kind of listening to some of the old ones. But definitely
it's one of those ones where it's kind of unless they say I'll go and listen to this one, it's better to take it week by week, I think. There's been a few sort of techie ones, aren't there? Like, I think there was one about ransomware, and this was before all the NHS ransomware stuff. And there was one about someone, I think his dad's Microsoft Surface got hacked somehow. I'd have to listen to that one again to find out. But they go into this kind of from a non-techie point of view, but they go into it enough to understand and be able to explain it to us. Someone that might not understand it, and it's quite interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit random. It's about taking drugs, and they took drugs on the show, and I'm halfway through where one of the children in this family had cancer, and they basically made a video game as they're grieving.
I think that was one of the first podcasts made me cry. That one. it's really good.
I haven't got to the end of that yet, but it's a bit of a
it's difficult but it's worth it. I looked into the game as well, I think.
Anyway, we'll put a link in the show notes to that, so
cool. I think that's pretty much all we've got time for, isn't
it?
One more thing I wanted to mention was the we are going to start up a Patreon, aren't we?
Yes.
If people would like to contribute, mainly, I'm sure that everyone's aware of the dire audio quality of my audio on every episode. So we're going to try and shoot for a new mic for me to start off with. I hope no one minds me asking, but to buy me a new mic. But that's what I'm asking. So. If anyone would like to contribute to our Patreon, which I've actually, at the time of recording, I've yet to set it up, but it should be at adminadminpodcast.co.uk/Patreon. And that should, by the time you get this, that should take you to somewhere where you can contribute your hard-earned money to a new mic for me. So if anyone fancies it, then yeah, go for it. Thanks in advance. Thank you very much.
Cool. Okay, so yeah, I think we're just about there, aren't we? So thanks again for listening, and thank you again, Joe, for the doing the production of the episode.
It sounded mint.
Best episode ever.
Also, don't forget our social media connections, Twitter, Facebook, all that, or even good old email.
And remember to do the our Telegram group as well.
Telegram group. Forgot about
got
that.
Some on there, people chatting and stuff. So it's quite good little techie stuff going through there when we come along, when we find something. So that's quite good. So,
yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, speak to you all soon.
See you later. Bye. Bye.